This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll hear of a recent court victory in the case of Acorn versus United States of America.
If you've ever heard of a bill of attainder, this show will tell you about it and tell you how Democrats and Republicans and our president all collapsed in voting for a clearly unconstitutional cutoff of funding for Acorn.
Why Are We in Afghanistan is the title of Michael Zweig's new film.
I think everybody's been wondering. Even President Obama doesn't have a good answer. Listen to this show and you'll get a lot more information about why we're in Afghanistan.
Stay with us.
Today is January 11th, 2010, and it's a important anniversary for all of us to mark. It's the 8th anniversary of the opening and imprisonment of the first people at Guantanamo. One would have thought that some 8 years after Guantanamo was opened as an offshore penal colony where interrogation and torture were the order of the day, that we would finally have that notorious prison closed. But that's not the case. There are still 198 people left at Guantanamo, and I don't think there is any real plan for getting that facility closed. When Obama took office a year ago, he promised that it would close on January 22nd of 2010. That promise will not be met. It was the Center for Constitutional Rights, where I, Michael Ratner, work, that began the first Guantanamo cases some 8 years ago. Our first client was David Hicks, an Australian. David has been released and is living in Australia. Some 575 other people have been released as well, but the facility remains opened. The latest incident, of course, that is being used particularly by the right wing, but to which the Obama administration caved, is the claim that a released prisoner, a released Guantanamo person, was somehow behind the Christmas Day attempt to bomb a Northwest Airlines. Sadly, this is now being used as an excuse by the Obama administration to say they are not going to release any other Guantanamo detainees to Yemen. Of the 198 left at Guantanamo, some 90 are from Yemen. A number of those 90 Yemen detainees have been cleared for release. But now the Obama administration, in a cave-in to the right wing and some Democrats, has said they are stopping all releases to Yemen. What's interesting about the Christmas Day alleged bombing is the one person who was released, of course, by the Bush administration, and was released without any of the procedures and processes that are now in place that ensure that people are not people who will become terrorists. In addition, the person released to Yemen turns out, of all things, to be a Saudi. So the fact now that they're putting this all on Yemen, stopping releases from Guantanamo to Yemen, makes it all the more difficult to close Guantanamo. So as we enter the 9th year of Guantanamo, the Center for Constitutional Rights and hundreds of other lawyers still continue to go to court, continue to fight for the release of the Guantanamo detainees. Sadly, not only is Guantanamo still in place in the current administration, but the practices and policies underlying Guantanamo are still in place. That includes preventive detention, in other words, holding people without charges or without a trial. It includes the military commissions to try people if and when the administration decides to try them. It includes the existence of Bagram, where now that Guantanamo is under the lens of many lawyers in the courts, the administration now keeps people, and it includes the Obama administration's vigorous assertion of state secrets to keep from the American people its actions at Guantanamo, its actions at Bagram, and the former administration's actions at secret sites. So while sure we're a little bit better off, we still have Guantanamo, and we still have the underpinnings of a police state in the new administration. This does not mean there's nothing you can do about it. On this very day, January 11th, there will be demonstrations across the country, sponsored in part by the Center for Constitutional Rights and Witness Against Torture. There's one in New York. You should check out the website of the center or witness against torture. There's a big one in Washington and in other places. So if you want to finally put an end to the abomination that is Guantanamo, please demonstrate, speak out, and insist that the aspects of a police state that were implemented by Bush should not be continued by Obama.
Recently, a federal judge blocked congressional efforts to withhold funding to the community group ACORN. In the decision, the court found that ACORN can show that the targeting by Congress in defunding the anti-poverty group is a violation of the Constitution's prohibition against a bill of attainder. This is a legislative act which singles out a specific person or group for punishment. Jules Obel, Center for Constitutional Rights Vice President and Cooperating Attorney, says, quote, "This historic decision by the court affirms the fundamental constitutional principle that the Congress cannot be judge, jury, and executioner." Following the decision, Bertha Lewis, ACORN's executive director, said, "The court's decision is a victory not only for the many dedicated citizens who work with ACORN to improve their communities and promote responsible lending and home ownership, but also for the Constitution and the rights of all Americans." We are delighted today to have Bertha Lewis in the studio with us. Welcome to Law and Disorder, Bertha.
Well, thank you for having me.
We love having you here and see you walking around. I know ACORN's been going through a lot, but why don't you give our listeners a little bit of background on what ACORN does, how big it is, what role it plays in our society?
Well, let me just say that ACORN is 39 years old. This year we started, of all places, in Little Rock, Arkansas, in 1970. ACORN, which stands for the Association of Community Organizations for Reform, now actually grew out of the welfare rights movement from the 50s and the 60s. And George Wiley.
I was going to say George Wiley is who
had been right. The founder of the WRO, said, you know, we really do need to organize a majority constituency. That is, you know, poor people are the majority, really, in this country. We need to be a multi-ethnic, multicultural, multi-issue organization, so that you build an institution where people that are usually left out have real power. And I emphasize that word, not empowerment, but real power. And so we began to organize folks in the South first, just around bread and butter issues, you know, whether it was a pothole or stop sign, empty lots, redlining. When banks were redlining to stop that, block busting, when people would use racist strategies to bust up neighborhoods saying, you know, black people are coming and poor people are coming. And so I think what most people would know us by was the housing work that we did, how we challenged the banks for their redlining tactics. If folks, you know, remember back the savings and loan crisis, when that was the bailout of the moment, and there were those of us who organized and said, whoa, there's a thing called the Community Reinvestment Act, and you can't bail out these banks unless you enforce the Community Reinvestment Act, and brought redlining and bad practices by banks to the fore. We began to...
Now, I remember some of those cases in New York.
Right.
We had one in the Bronx, I think,
that's
with you
right.
guys.
That's right. That's right.
And how long have you been with ACORN?
Well, I was the executive director for New York,
right.
And I've been with ACORN almost 20 years now.
Wow. You know, you're head of the whole operation, right?
Well, yeah. How did that happen?
Well.
Who would have thunk it? You know, the board in June of 2008 looked at where we were at. And, you know, we've always been honest and open. We really did have a minor internal scandal where we found that the founder, Wade Rathke, had allowed his brother, 2-year period of time, to misappropriate almost $1 million. And this is especially troublesome when it's a poor people's organization. But our board immediately fired Wade, fired his brother, and asked me to become the CEO because of my work in building New York ACORN into a powerhouse not only, you know, building housing and running campaigns, and from the minimum wage to stopping predatory lending to school and education reform. And so when I took over, I immediately began to reform the organization. We're the best organizers.
Everybody knows it.
The universe.
That's probably what's called forth of the problems.
But we're not the best managers. And my philosophy is that, you know, we should be as good of managers as we are of organizers.
We're speaking with Bertha Lewis, who's the executive director of ACORN. Bertha, tell us, we have a wonderful victory we want to talk about.
Yes.
But to get to the point of what we're able to do to defend you and you're prevailing over them, tell us how it seemed to me it was like a sting operation. Tell us what happened and how you fought back.
Well, you have to go back as far back as 2000. The right has, I guess, have seen us as a growing threat. We were becoming bigger. We were very effective on the ground, doing it the old-fashioned way. And so how dare we register people to vote? And so almost immediately we were accused of, you know, voter registration fraud, voter fraud. You know, we were going to have all kinds of crazy people vote. And then when that didn't pan out, as I said, with the Attorneygate scandal and U.S. attorneys came back over and over and saying, there's no there there. These people aren't committing any fraud. Then when you had your internal scandal with the embezzlement, which, by the way, had been covered up unbeknownst to all of us for 8 years, unbeknownst to the board or anyone. So that gave them an opening. So now, because we'd gotten better at voter registration, that just brought back up voter registration allegations. But still, because we had been cleaning up, nothing was sort of resonating and sticking. You know, investigate them. They're probably using federal funds to do partisan work. They had to go back 15 years to look at an accumulation of maybe $2 to $3 million a year. To 54, you know, million for an organization of 500,000 members. So it seemed as though nothing was sticking. And what happened? You can't underestimate these people. They decided, well, we've got to keep them in the news. We've got to keep attacking them, make them the symbol. What can we do? If we can't find any wrongdoing, let's create it. Let's make it up. And so this filmmaker, videographer, O'Keefe, who has pulled this kind of thing on other progressive groups before, made up this whole fantasy scenario, and which really was racist and sexist on its face. Because we're an organization of black and brown folks and poor folks, well, if you're going to pull a sting operation, dress up or pretend to be a pimp and a prostitute, because, of course, that's what black people, minority people, poor people, that's what they understand. So they had this series of videos. When you looked at it, it was very sensational. Anyone could tell immediately that these things were chopped up, highly edited, where they seemed to have this woman, Miss Giles, come in and say, oh, I'm a prostitute and I need your help, you know, haven't paid taxes. And oh, by the way, there's these underage girls from Honduras that we want to bring across the border and start a brothel. So what you believe that you see on these sensational tapes are some of our workers answering questions and saying, let me give you advice about this, this, and this, all put together. So that, of course, you know, put it on the internet, goes viral. Because we've got sex, we've got, you know, violence and, you know, nefarious doings. And aha, told you that ACORN.
Yeah, we got ACORN at the end of it.
they are a criminal organization. And what that precipitated now was something that was so sensational. The next thing you know, you've got funders saying, oh, ooh, we don't want to be associated with you. And so 3 times prior to this, the right, all Republicans had tried to put in defund ACORN language. Oh, they shouldn't get any taxpayer dollars to do the evil things that they do.
What were you getting money for?
For helping people on foreclosure, counseling folks to stay in their homes or to make sure that they got decent loans, lead abatement, education, outreach to protect children and families from lead, that kind of thing. And, you know, putting fire extinguishers, making sure that poor people had fire extinguishers in their homes to prevent any disaster, making sure that they got the services that they needed to make their homes safe.
And again, this was federal funding for this.
Like $2 or $3 million a year spread across.
So mostly housing and safety.
Mostly
issues.
Housing, counseling, and just being able to do outreach to folks. That's
how many people work
was.
For ACORN over
at that time, you know, we had almost 500 organizers. We had 400,000 member families. We were in almost 40 some states. So $2 to $3 million is not a lot of money, but it was monies that we used in order to leverage other money to do these services, fight predatory lending and subprime loans. So three times before the Republicans had tried to, you know, ACORN is a criminal organization, you know, no due process. And finally, what happened, those little undercover videos, that did the trick. That was salacious enough. That was something everybody can understand. And in October, the continuing resolution to fund the government, they put in language that said no funds shall ever be given to ACORN, its subsidiaries, its affiliates, or anyone. It was very broad.
Let me read it. It said, none of the funds made available by this joint resolution or any prior act may be provided to the Association of Community Organizations for Reform Now, ACORN, or any of its affiliates, subsidiaries, or allied organizations. And this was put into an omnibus funding bill in October, cutting off any kind of current contracts, future contracts, anything to do with the federal government.
For any work done, any, and when you say allies.
Right, what does that mean?
That really is very chilling.
This passed, right?
This passed not only in October.
What was the vote
like? In October, it was overwhelming. We only had seven brave senators in the Senate that voted against it and about 75 folks in the House that voted against it. Those truly were people that had principle.
And I think Jerry Nadler voted against
it. He led the charge. Thank God for Congressman Nadler, because his whole thing was, look, this is not about whether ACORN is criminal or not or good or bad. This is about the Constitution. You cannot name, single out one organization for punishment, you know, or infamy. And what was funny about this is, remember I told you like three times before they tried to do this? Well, the first couple times what they'd done was they had language. Well, any organization that is under investigation or is indicted or has been indicted, and trying to be very broad, but thinking to tailor this to ACORN. Well, they dispensed with that language. And here's why. Because we've never been convicted of anything. But folks like Blackwater, KBR, Halliburton, and on and on and on.
That's great.
People who have actually committed fraud against the government, they must have called their congressman and said, whoa, we could be ensnared in this net. And so in a way, they were pushed to have to name ACORN specifically, because otherwise their friends would have been hurt too. But that was when they were hoist on their own petard.
You took that phrase out of my mouth.
Right, because this is Article 1, Section 9 of the Constitution. It's called a Bill of Attainder, is what one would litigate this under. It was put in by the original framers of the Constitution because they didn't want the legislature essentially acting as a judiciary. If you're going to convict someone of something, go to court, supposedly independent. Don't let the legislature start convicting people and taking away either their rights, giving them penalties, etc.
Well, that brings us actually to the next development, and that would be the Center for Constitutional Rights bringing a case.
I call them Jedi Knights for Justice.
But how did
Bertha, you've always been unbelievable.
How did the case come to be?
In October, when they added this, this was temporary, and it only was supposed to go to October 30th. Again, Congressman Nadler was the first one to point out, hold it, Congress, you may be committing an unconstitutional act. This is a bill of attainder. Bill of attainder? Why? You know,
I've never been out of law school for 42 years. I never saw it used.
And so it was kind of weird. So we began to look for folks saying, is this legal? Can they do that? Not only because it wasn't right and unfair to us. And we began to search around and for lawyers that could deal with this and help us out. And by that time, and some folks felt, well, this is just temporary. They won't do this again in October because the Congressional Research Office had actually written a memo saying, Congress, don't continue this because this is a bill of attainder. But lo and behold, they put the language in again in the continuing resolution. That resolution brought it through November, and they did it again, and it brought it through to December 18th.
These continuing resolutions are all ways we fund the government when a spending bill has not been passed yet.
Or you have not passed the full budget.
Right.
So, in essence, if you remember, Newt Gingrich, during the Clinton era, threatened to not vote for a continuing resolution and to shut the government down. So essentially, the right and the Republicans in the government were willing to shut the government down just to punish Acorn. And unfortunately, a lot of Democrats just went along to get along. And so we began to search for folks to help us because we knew it wasn't for us about some $2 or $3 million a year in funding. Whether we were guilty of anything or not, if you could do it to us, who's next? Our liberty and our freedom and our rights under this Constitution were in jeopardy. And so we felt we had to bring the case no matter what. And you go to court, you take your chances. But it doesn't matter because you have to do the right thing. And I am so happy today to say that Judge Gershon here in New York wrote a 21-page decision that clearly said the government cannot do this. This is unconstitutional. And Acorn should be restored to all of its contracts and just even permit it to compete, not to guarantee us anything. And that we were punished and the infamy from being named like this was injurious to us, and she enjoined the entire government and said, you know, you've got to stop this.
What's interesting about the decision is there's only been five cases in the Supreme Court on bills of attainder in which a congressional legislation is held illegal as a bill of attainder. This one was slightly different because a normal case you would think, and I actually thought before I really started reading around, was that bills of attainder only applied when you gave someone a punishment, such as going to jail or something like that. Not that could it apply to taking away money from someone. But there were precedents for what happened here that were positive for us. And eventually Judge Gershon found that this was a punishment. And she talked about what some of the members of Congress said on the floor about this, which made it clearly into a punishment. One thing I want to give real thanks to is, I mean, not just the Center for Constitutional Rights, but the lawyer who argued the case, who's one of our stars, Jules Lobel, from the University of Pittsburgh.
Another Jedi Knight for
Justice.
He's
amazing. And he took this case on despite being overwhelmed with other work and just said, and when I saw him on the street one day, I said, Jules, how are we going to do? He says, Michael, this is like, there's no issue here. This case, this is a bill of attainder. I said, Jules, but isn't it very involved in politics and everything and what's going to happen? And he said, sure, these are always political, but if you get a fair judge here, we're going to win. And you did. And so,
well, Jules LaBelle and Bill Quigley from the Center for Constitutional Rights, they are my new heroes. They really
they did a great
should be
job.
Commended. Yeah.
Is the government going to appeal this decision?
Well, tell us where we are now, because this is a continuing resolution. This one expires December 18th, which, because we're recording, but is a couple of days ago. What's going to happen after this expires?
Here's the problem. The reason, you know, it could have been argued, well, just wait. It's going to expire December 18th. But they'd already renewed it. And we saw this, and the damage was already done. We haven't gotten a notice of appeal, but we feel as though the government definitely, well, just on general principle, will have to appeal. You know, government tried to argue that this wasn't punishment, but, you know, so they have to appeal, I think, just on general principle. Here's the other thing. A judge was very clear that this was a bill of attainder and that our funds and contracts needed to be restored and that they should never do this again. Well, it just didn't seem to make any difference because the continuing resolution, the December 18th deadline, didn't matter because an omnibus bill, a real appropriations bill, has been passed and is sitting awaiting President Obama's signature. And guess what? Maybe, you know, the language is still in there.
The same language, precisely the same.
And they could say that, oh, we drew this up before the judge's decision, but it doesn't matter. And either Congress needed to just stand up and say, let's amend this. You know, we now have a court order. And that's what's troubling because, you know, maybe it's okay to trample the Constitution. Maybe it's okay not to obey a judge's order because it's just that little poor people's organization. But the American public really should be concerned about this type of behavior and the fact that this was a just decision. And it seems as though swift justice for poor people and people of color in this country doesn't really matter.
Of course, the administration could say, we're not going to sign a bill with an unconstitutional provision, or as I said in one of my notes, that even the current president does signing statements. Why didn't he write a signing statement saying we won't enforce an unconstitutional provision? That would be nice to see.
From your mouth to Obama's ears, it would be good. It would be good not only if the president did that, but wouldn't it be a wonderful thing that if folks stood up in Congress, those who had voted for this defund ACORN provision because they were caught up in this bogus video hysteria, wouldn't it be good to have some real profiles and courage in Congress and have those people stand up and say, I was wrong and we should take this out?
Well, as the great organizers that you have in ACORN, what will be done to try to influence those legislators to do something like that?
Well, we were trying to influence these legislators not to take the action that they did, but call your senator, call your congressman, and say, stand up for the Constitution. Stand up for the people that you represent. Make sure that this bill of attainder and this language targeting one group is taken out. Stand up and take a stand. So donate and call your call your congresspeople.
Do you have a website, Bertha, that we can link to on Law and Disorder?
ACORN.org.
Say
very
it again.
Plain. ACORN.org. ACORN.org.
Bertha, as we've watched over the last year, really, efforts to unravel ACORN, Your personal courage in standing up has been really admirable, and it's great to see.
Thank you. Thank you, because I have I got good allies, and they're good guys like you all. Like,
well, poor allies, we're not going to be funded anymore.
Bertha Lewis, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. I love you guys. Thank you. Jedi Knights for Justice.
That's great.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. Meet the King.
king of cowboys. He rides a pale pony. He fights the bad boys, brings them to their knees. He patrols the highways from the air. He keeps the country safe from long hair. I'm the masculine American man. I kill.
Why are we in Afghanistan is the question many listeners have and is the title of a film by Michael Zweig. The film examines how the reasons for the Afghanistan war have clouded since September 11, 2001. There are no al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. The conflict centers on geopolitical positioning that holds the U.S. in the war-torn landscape. At this stage, the Afghanistan war is a humanitarian disaster. And the civilian casualties are stunning. Conditions on the ground are desperate for Afghani women and children. The film, Why Are We in Afghanistan, is an educational resource for communities, unions, veterans, and active duty military people. It can be used in classes and given to anyone who's wondering why we're in Afghanistan and what to do about it. We are joined by writer and director of the film, Michael Zweig. Michael Zweig is a professor at Stony Brook and runs the Center for Working Class Life.
Well, Michael Zweig, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
And I actually just got your CD or the DVD in the mail called Why We Are in Afghanistan. And I know I worked with you in the past, particularly on Iraq stuff and read your labor stuff on Iraq and saw a video. And now the question is Afghanistan. So tell me, first off, apart from the DVD, why are we in Afghanistan?
Well, it's complicated. We started out being in Afghanistan because of the 9/11 attacks, and the idea was they attacked us from Afghanistan, and that was the base of operations, and we were going to go there and get the bad guys. And before 9/11, there really was not a great interest in Afghanistan particularly. But once we were there, and we pushed out the Taliban, and we're going after Osama bin Laden at the end of 2001, the intentions of the Bush administration became fairly clear that they were not really interested in Afghanistan. They were not really interested in getting Osama bin Laden. They were interested in going into Iraq for completely other reasons, had nothing to do with Afghanistan. So starting in the middle of 2002, the focus really left Afghanistan. And we were there, presumably going after al-Qaeda in an inactive and inappropriate way. And it kind of dragged along for 7 years while we were occupied in Iraq, occupying Iraq. Then comes the somewhat resolution, presumably, of Iraq. Obama comes in and tries to be the president and is running on a campaign, if we can remember, last year, of prosecuting the good war. We're going to get out of Iraq, which was the mistake.
Right, what he called the war of necessity.
The war of necessity.
Which is Afghanistan.
Yeah, Iraq was the war of choice, which is a euphemism for a war crime.
Well, that's what he was saying. And so now the question is, why are we now doubling down in Afghanistan? And I think that it doesn't do to just say, well, it was al-Qaeda, because that was then and this is now.
But in fact, if we look at, I want to hear much more, but if we go to Obama's speech of a couple of weeks ago, if you look through that speech, there's only one reason given in the speech, really, and it's really al-Qaeda. Or the Taliban also sheltering al-Qaeda.
That's right.
What their position, at least, has been on the escalation.
They continue to say that that's really what it's about. However, they're also prosecuting this thing in a way that involves nation building and it involves stabilizing Afghanistan, presumably, again, so that al-Qaeda doesn't have a base of operations there. Now, that doesn't completely make sense because they don't have a base of operations there. They're in Pakistan. And if you would stabilize Afghanistan and Pakistan, they would go to Somalia. And right. if you would go after them in Somalia, then they'd be in Yemen, or then they would be in Sudan, or then they'd be in, back in Afghanistan. So it's like whack-a-mole trying to, you know, beat these guys down. The whole idea that we're fighting the terrorists and doing a counterterrorism operation contradicts the insurgency doctrine. They're two very different things.
Right. Insurgency is really much more about nation building, or at least about making the nation, quote, stable, rather than just wiping out a few terrorists.
That's right. But if you look at American counterinsurgency doctrine, which David Petraeus wrote with others and was published in 2006, it's a very interesting document that I actually read. They accept the idea that counterinsurgency is about 80% civilian work and taking care of the civilian population and only 20% military. And it's interesting that they get that from the Chinese communist insurgency in the 40s, where that was Mao's dictum, right? Our task is principally a political task, and the military is a side. It's important, but it really fits into this political process, and we have to conduct our military affairs in a way that bolsters our political mission. American doctrine says 80%, roughly, resources should be in civilian and 20% military. But if you actually look at the allocation of funds in the budget that's right now in place for 2010, it's 6% civilian and 94% military.
So what's going on?
So it's completely upside right. down, right?
This isn't really about counterinsurgency.
It isn't really about counterinsurgency. It isn't really about getting al-Qaeda. So what could it be about, right? Well, there's a couple of things. There's the domestic needs of the Obama campaign to be tough on terror the way that people used to be tough on communists, and to be a Democrat who knows how to fight and is, you know, comfortable with the military.
What do you mean campaign? He's already won the campaign. You talk about the next time he runs?
You see, this is the one campaign promise that he's actually delivered on.
That's right. That's right.
Is the only going one. Into Afghanistan and doubling down.
And he has a congressional election coming up, and he has the next campaign. Yeah. So he doesn't want to appear weak for those, quote, weak. Right?
That's right. So I think that we shouldn't downplay the importance of the domestic political and military pressure to do this.
I always hear that is so sad because it's basically saying we're going to send people overseas to get killed and kill other people because the guy wants to win another election.
Well, that's
yeah, but what you're doing, Michael, is you're blaming it on the American people. I don't think there's a lot of interest amongst the population here to go fight in Afghanistan.
Well, I think that
I'd rather see it blamed on the inertia of the military that wants to keep doing interventions like this.
Well,
no?
You know, I think that it depends exactly what time you're talking about. If you're talking about 2007, 2008, I think that broadly among the American public, and certainly in the labor movement where I'm focused my work, there was an idea that Afghanistan was the good war. And there was an idea that Iraq took us away from where we had to go to really get the bad guys. I think that that was a broad sentiment. And certainly even at the beginning of 2009, when we were trying through U.S. Labor Against the War to bring Afghanistan into the labor movement, there was a lot of resistance in just informal discussions that we were having with our members and with our leadership that, you know, we really have to be careful about how far we go about Afghanistan because people want to go there. People want to fight this. That changed in the course of the summer and into the fall of 2009. So by this time, at the end of 2009, I think very broadly there is a feeling that we do not belong there and it is not a good idea. Now, how that plays out in the way that the Obama people run this war, it remains to be seen. But I think that there are also other considerations for why we're there.
Yes, let's hear what they are,
so,
Michael.
Well, you know, there's this, you know, Pipelinistan idea, you know, that there are pipelines to be had. And people have pointed out that the United States kind of dropped the ball after the Russians left in 1989. The United States also left, and that allowed the Taliban to come into power in 1994, 95. So what happened in the 10 years since then, or 15 years since then, that would give us some strategic interest. Well, several things happened. Number one, the collapse of the Soviet Union, not just that they withdrew, but the Soviet Union collapsed, and so all the Central Asian republics, all the other stands, Turkmenistan, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, all those places, which are very rich in oil and natural gas, came into play in the international political and geopolitical arena because the Soviets lost their grip on them. So then there was an opportunity to actually get access to those resources, so the U.S. then could have a reason to be there which didn't exist before. Also, China has developed, everyone knows, as a major industrial power, and they need energy. The U.S. Department of Energy has forecast that between the year 2000 and the year 2025, China's need to import oil is going to increase to 73% of its oil needs. They're going to have to import.
Wow.
It's a huge amount of oil. And so the Chinese are very much interested in the Central Asian republics because they're close by. The pipelines can be built rather easily into China if they can secure, you know, their northwest, which is the Uyghurs and all the conflicts that they have there. Well,
I'm going to go back a second on that proxy war, because I have read something about that.
Yeah.
India has put $1.2 billion into Afghanistan, and that worries Pakistan. Pakistan is saying on some level, we already have India as a problem on our border.
Right.
Now we're going to wind up with India on the northern side of us.
That's right.
And we're not going to allow that to happen.
That's
and
right.
So for Pakistan, in some way, they're looking at this as you're putting it into it, as its fight with India.
That's right. And Pakistan's agent in Afghanistan are the Taliban, because Pakistan was the supporters and the creators of the Taliban forces.
Now, what makes sense about that, and I thought the article that said a lot the other day, was the Jane Perlis piece in the New York Times that said the U.S. has gone to Pakistan and said, we want you to help us wipe out this warlord Hiddiki, who is sitting in your territory. He's Taliban, and his people are attacking our troops in Afghanistan. And Pakistan says, we're not going to do it.
Yeah, because he's our guy.
Right.
Because he's their guy.
He's
right?
Someone we need ultimately against India.
Against India. That's
exactly.
Right. And so the U.S. is in the middle of this, trying to sort it out in order to have some stability there. Now, we also have the issue of pipelines, which is not nothing. I don't think it's the whole story. But in the 1990s, and it's well reported and well documented, Unocal, which was a moderate-sized American oil company, was negotiating with the Taliban and with Pakistan to build a pipeline that would come down from Turkmenistan, which is north to the northwest of Afghanistan, to come down through Afghanistan into Pakistan and out to the Arabian Sea, so that oil and natural gas could come out of the Central Asian republics without going through Iran and without going through Russia and without having to go through a pipeline under the Caspian into Georgia. If you remember Georgia and the conflict with the Soviets and the American interest in Georgia is also related to pipeline issues that could get oil and gas out of the Central Asian republics into Europe. So Unocal was trying to negotiate this deal, and they had some support from the State Department, but it wasn't a major item for the Clinton administration. And it really didn't go anywhere because the Taliban weren't interested, and because there was instability, there wasn't any real prospect of building a major pipeline. So that kind of fell apart. Then what I found out in researching this new film, this Why Are We in Afghanistan film, which I've just released, there were meetings in 2002 in Turkmenistan with the Bush administration where they were pushing a pipeline that would go also from Turkmenistan down into Balochistan out to the Arabian Sea with the support of the Asia Development Bank. The U.S. got the Asia Development Bank involved, and they were negotiating with the Pakistanis, with the Afghan government in 2000. There was a desire to build this pipeline. These negotiations were not reported, as far as I can tell, anywhere in the United States, but they were reported in the local press in Turkmenistan, which was translated, and that got picked up on certain websites in the United States and is documented, which is where I found these things. The Bush administration, one of the very first things they did in 2001, even before 9/11, they had a commission on energy policy that Dick Cheney famously chaired, which we're all trying to find out who was there, right? And they won't tell
us. That's the one we got stopped by the government and then the courts.
That's right. And we don't know who was in the meetings. But we do know that it was oil executives and the big energy executives. And they issued a report in May 2001, this is before 9/11, on American energy strategy for the coming period. And they identified the Central Asian republics as a major source of oil and natural gas with resources in excess of what the U.S. has right now. More than what's in the United States is there. They identified, this is Cheney and his crew, identified that area as an area of interest for the U.S. to explore and to have access to those resources and also to block other, you know, the Chinese and other people getting those resources. So in the strategic thinking of the American administration in the Bush era, even before 9/11, Afghanistan and that area was on the radar screen. It was on the map. We're there because of a broad, both the strategic interests, which include those oil resources for ourselves and to block others so that others don't get it.
I don't want to let Obama off the hook on this. I thought that the speech he gave at West Point and the speech he gave in Oslo, despicable. He should have been given the Nobel War Prize. And I don't want to transmit the idea that somehow he's only reacting to sentiment from the American people on this war. His whole notion that the United States, he spelled this out in his speech in Oslo, was that the United States has been responsible for good things in the security of the world for the last 60 years is just not true. My question to you is, what do we do about it? What's it going to take to get them out of Afghanistan? Because I agree with you that we, you and I, and people like us have no interest in being in Afghanistan. What can we do about it? Other than see your excellent movie, Michael Zog, why are we in Afghanistan?
I want to talk about that as well. And I want to add to Michael's question, because you did say, well, Obama knows and there's no way out. And, you know, I'm just... maybe he's not hearing from the right people. Maybe that's what he thinks. But, you know, I talked to people at the UN over the years, people who were negotiators and diplomats, and they said that starting 2 or 3 years ago and even going on today, that they could be negotiating with the Taliban for ending the war. And they could have 3 years ago when the Taliban was weaker, could have actually made a deal that was much better. And as it continues, the Taliban, maybe they're going to try and get them weaker again by the 30,000 troops we just added. I don't think there was no way out. You know, my view is certainly one thing because I'm a certain position. But even for them, there was a reasonable position put forth by various people, including the Saudis put forth a plan, a four-point plan or something, to get the U.S. out and to negotiate with the Taliban.
Absolutely.
So I can't say that Obama couldn't hear that.
Well, when I was looking into this, I was thinking back to a book that I read 25 years ago by the historian Barbara Tuchman. It's called The March of Folly.
I didn't read that one by her, but I read other Barbara Tuchman.
So The March of Folly is a very interesting book. It's about Vietnam and how did we get into this. But what Barbara Tuchman looks at is this phenomenon where the leadership of countries leads them into disastrous courses against the advice and against alternative policies which are known at the time.
Right. So that's what I would say this is that situation.
That's why I say that this war is another step in the march of folly.
Right.
You can't necessarily reduce it all to simple rational calculation because there are other courses that they could do. See, the idea that we should negotiate politically, look what kind of trouble they're getting just to get health care, just to get a public option. It can't be done unless you really stand up to this whole array of interests who are going to just pour down on your head all this vitriol, all these lies, all this stuff about the guy is a traitor and all sorts of problems.
Right.
That's clear that would happen if he said, we're going to negotiate with the Taliban, we're not going to send another 30,000 troops, we're going to withdraw, and we're going to do this thing right. We're going to mobilize an international diplomatic force. We're going to settle Pakistani-Indian thing. When they sent Dick Holbrooke over there to deal with this situation as a special representative, right, for Afghanistan and Pakistan. They explicitly excluded Kashmir from his brief. Well, how can you ever hope to solve the problem in Afghanistan diplomatically unless you solve this proxy battle between India and Pakistan, which you cannot solve unless you deal with Kashmir?
Okay, so this all brings me to the question of what do we do? I mean, well, I want to talk about the film for a second.
Yeah.
Because you're saying Obama, this is what's happened. He's going to get killed by the Blue Dog Democrats, you know, the Republicans and all this, and therefore he feels whatever he really thinks. Because I don't think it's worth speculating on what Obama thinks
because
he has to do what he acts on.
That's right.
And so but then the question is, how do we make it hot for him for the decisions
he's
made?
Well, that's right.
That's really, to me, the ultimate question.
That's the question, which is, how do you build a social movement?
Right.
Where I'm working is mainly in the labor movement.
Right, and we should hear about that because people on our show, we don't cover that a lot. So.
Well, there's some very important things going on because we have built since 2003, in the run-up to the Iraq War, U.S. Labor Against the War, which is a coalition or an organization of about now 190 union locals, central labor councils, state federations of labor, major labor bodies representing over 5 million workers in the United States. And we have got the labor movement focused on Iraq, in the opposition to Iraq, to bring the troops home, working in association with Iraq veterans and with military families speak out. And we've built quite a presence in the labor movement around Iraq, and we're now moving towards Afghanistan. And as you know, when we started to make that move in early 2009, at the end of 2008, there was that resistance, oh no, it's the good war. Now we're seeing it really is possible to bring out resolutions and to bring activity around Afghanistan, largely because of the money, largely because of the economic interests. And that here we have a jobs program, right? And President Obama comes and has this job summit, and he says, well, we want to have a lot of jobs, but let's not forget that we have very limited resources.
I thought if there was anything that could lose him the election, it was that jobs meeting.
Well, I mean,
I said, if he's going to lose this election, it's going to be because of employment and because of a statement like that.
So wait a second. We don't have any money. Where's the money? Give me a break.
Spending $1 million per person
for troops
that they're sending over to Afghanistan.
So they're spending now $65 billion a year, and now they're going to add another 30. So it's almost $100 billion a year in Afghanistan. Well, that's a lot of money. And you could generate a lot of jobs. You could have a big stimulus program. You could give people some tax relief. You could do all kinds of stuff with that money. So we in the labor movement don't want to hear about there's no money.
Right. I mean, I thought that was like an amazing statement.
Well, it is an amazing statement. So the connection between the war and the economy is something that's an important thing to identify. Now, sometimes people have the idea, well, the war is good for the economy because it, you know, it generates jobs, you have the war industry, you have people making Humvees, you have people making uniforms. Well, it turns out for every dollar spent on military spending, you create way fewer jobs than the same money spent building roads or building turbines for wind farms.
Well, that's important.
And so the job content of government spending is an important consideration for the labor movement, and we are paying attention to that. And it's also, if you look at who's fighting these wars, they're working class people.
Right.
And that's who we represent in the labor movement. So those are our sons and daughters, uncles, aunts, members who are fighting. And we, as the labor movement, seek to protect our members.
You made a film. It's called Why Are We in Afghanistan?
Right.
I know you can get this film. You can actually stream it online, and you can actually get it from you
as
a website. But tell us for a second, what is it? What am I going to see if I see this film?
Well, the film is, and you can see it at whyarewein.org. Just go to whyarewein.org. The full version is about 28 minutes, and it recounts the history of American involvement, not just in Central Asia and in Iraq, but as a colonial and imperial power, and also the history of the peace movement in the United States. So when we're talking about the peace movement, building a peace movement now, we're not talking about something which is foreign to American tradition. As much as there's been a history of American colonial and imperial adventure going all the way back to the Mexican War in 1848, and the Spanish-American War, and then after World War II, all the different interventions. We try in this film to place Afghanistan and Iraq in that historical context and the peace movement in that historical context, and then also look at the specifics of these pipelines and the economic interests, and look at maps and where is Afghanistan and where is Turkmenistan. You know, when I started making this, I didn't know where Balochistan was. Somebody told me there's a pipeline running through Balochistan. Well, that's nice. Where the hell is Balochistan? So I got out the atlas, just as I did, you know, 35, 40 years ago. Where's Vietnam? Where's Laos? We had to find
out.
Yes,
I remember that.
And so this film we made as a way of people getting that information and using it as an educational resource. So if people go to whyarewe.org, they can actually see it. And then if they like what they see and they want to use it, they can order it. It's $9.95. It's, you know, price to go. And we hope that it becomes a resource for the labor movement, for the larger peace movement, for churches.
Sounds wonderful, particularly because you put it in the context of both U.S. adventure, imperialism, as well as the peace movement.
That's
sounds,
right. That's right. Sometimes, let me just say, sometimes we have the idea, those of us who are sort of anti-imperialists and understand this long history, that America's just, you know, an imperialist power. But as you were saying before, Mike, the idea of America is not one thing. And the American people have this long tradition of peace and the long tradition of an approach to a proper American role in the world that we need to respect, and we need to carry that tradition forward into the needs of the time today. And that's what this DVD, whyarewe.org, is designed to give people the resources to engage that.
Well, Michael Zweig, I can't tell you how much I admire you for doing this. I remember in the early days of Vietnam when I was at the University of Wisconsin, I wanted to do something against the war in Vietnam. The movement was just starting out. And one of my pals in the building I lived in, he and I went to a dormitory, and we yelled down the hall, "We're going to be talking about Vietnam." And we had three people in the lounge in the dormitory, and the janitor kind of poked his head around the corner, and he was listening in too. And we started out just going to dormitories and talking about Vietnam. Well, this movie, Why Are We in Afghanistan? You can go to a lot of dormitories with this movie and educate a lot of people.
That's right.
in a very efficient, wonderful way. You know, we're so proud of you, Michael Zweig, for doing this Why Are We in Afghanistan. We urge everybody to go on the net and look at it and get it around. And we thank you very much, Michael, for being on Law and Disorder.
Well,
thank you, Michael.
Thanks very much to both of you and to everybody.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.